listening to Law and Justice on UCC 98.3 FM. I'm Jane Mulcahy. It's Tuesday the 16th of January 2018. It's our first show of the season. We're delighted to be back and hope you're all doing well. You're all nicely rested and looking forward to a hopefully successful, healthy, happy 2018. We've a special extended feature with Anne-Marie Crean, who is a psychology student doing her PhD at UCC. She's also the co-founder of an organization called Reclaiming Self, which provides advocacy and support to survivors of historical abuse. So I hope you'll find that a very interesting piece from Anne-Marie, where she talks about the object and purpose of the organization. A recent report that Reclaiming Self wrote for the UN Committee Against Torture and their plans going forward. If people are affected by the piece, they can contact Anne-Marie at Reclaiming Self. Their website is going live soon. It's reclaimingself.ie. And Anne-Marie's email is a.crean@reclaimingself.ie.
My name is Anne-Marie Crean. I am the founder of Reclaiming Self charity, support for people who have experienced systematic abuse, institutional abuse, state abuse and religious abuse. I'm currently doing my PhD in the Department of Psychology.
What does Reclaiming Self aspire to achieve?
Well, basically, I established Reclaiming Self for a number of reasons. I had worked as a social support practitioner in this area of historic institutional child abuse for a number of years. I had people coming in to me from other forms of abuse in the schools, regular national schools, abused by a local clergy. And unfortunately, we weren't in a position, our children coming out of care today, you know, they're now adults, who came looking for support, but unfortunately the remit didn't allow for that to happen, for me to take them under, and I felt like I was referring them to services to other parts of the country and stuff like that. And as such, there was just a massive kind of gap, I suppose, that was noticed. But more importantly, when I had left my job and took time out and looked at the whole issue of abuse in this country, it really boiled down to the fact that there has been massive shortcomings in relation to how the state has dealt with the issue of abuse, historical or otherwise. And so I founded Reclaiming Self with the idea of trying to put together information, resources and challenge the state in relation to how it's handled abuse in general.
Can you give me some background about the issues surrounding abuse survivors or people, you know, who'd come through the industrial school system and the enduring difficulties that they may face?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, you know, some people have had some success in life, have been quite successful in life, and others, unfortunately, haven't been. From my previous employment and obviously through what I've been doing at the moment, through Reclaiming Self, I've had experiences in the multifarious issues that are being experienced by survivors and their families.
So it's intergenerational, it is. The trauma can be.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we have issues around, obviously within the schools they weren't provided proper education, and obviously we know that they were neglected, experiencing abuse, physical, sexual, a combination, emotional abuse and denigration. And I've actually worked with people who have come through the prison systems that have issues around homelessness, issues around education and literacy, issues with mental health, issues with some form of substance abuse, employment as a result, relationship issues. The issues are complex, they're multidimensional, and supports that need to be put in place need to be in a more structured environment that are more aware and more culturally appropriate to the needs of survivors.
Mm-hmm. And so, for example, say redress schemes where people are given some sort of money or compensation do not deal with most of the enduring needs that people may have.
No, well, I mean, the redress system was established in as a way of a form of civil litigation. Survivors came, gave their testimony to solicitors, and then engaged in a process where the redress board went to the religious orders. Allegations of abuse were actually accepted or denied, and there was basically money discussed then as a result of the experiences of abuse. And the thing about the redress system was that it was, for the most part, very difficult to navigate around for many survivors, and that it was a process that many of them felt they couldn't understand. They felt that they weren't engaged enough with their solicitors, they didn't see their barristers enough, that they had to go and for many the first time talk to somebody about their abuse. Many people felt that they weren't prepared, they weren't ready, that they had thought about it. Most definitely they didn't feel supported. And the redress system was, for those who went actually into the redress board and for an redress hearing, many of those people have reported that it's been exceptionally adversarial.
So it's like a trial for
them.
Yeah,
they were cross-examined on their evidence. A lot of the time the religious orders didn't turn up, so they were being cross-examined on evidence that was after being denied by people who mightn't even have been there. And many felt they weren't believed. One person said to me that they felt that they were even responsible for some of their own abuse. So they felt very blamed. And ultimately, as a system that was set up to support and to provide reparation, it has been basically a complete debacle. And survivors, even though they've received some form of compensation in monetary forms, the money has been provided on a waiting scale. Mm-hmm. And as such, you know, from what I understand and I believe from speaking to people, that it boils down to how people were able to articulate and understand how that abuse has affected them and their lives and their families. And many people mightn't been able to articulate that, or many people were really worried about what they were saying. And many people felt they didn't disclose enough at the time for fear and shame. And as such, you know, despite the fact that reparation was provided, in a study outsourced from Carinua, survivors in Ireland who have applied for access to that fund, over 50% of them are living in the 20 most socio-economic deprived areas of our country. Mm. Like the reparation that they received, the redress they received has had no impact on them. And that to me is really...
Living a more positive life, you mean?
Obviously,
okay.
So to me that really signifies that there is something really broken with the system. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's something... Something is short-circuited somewhere.
Sure.
You know, so...
And Anne-Marie, you guys in Reclaiming Self authored a report which you brought to the UN Committee Against Torture in Geneva in July last year. Can you give a brief overview of some of the points raised to the committee?
I know it's a tough question, because it was a long report and well-researched, but one or two were the headline issues.
2011, UNCAT came into Ireland and looked at, obviously, other... A lot of issues, both historical abuse issues and other issues that are currently going on in the country. And the state had been engaging with UNCAT since then, and have been providing details and information and reports, and have been in the sessions regarding historical institutional child abuse. I mean, the Justice for Magdalene's Crowd have been there advocating on behalf of Magdalene women.
Did tremendous
and
work.
They've done massive work. And really were trailblazing, to be honest. But unfortunately, within the historic institution child abuse, no survivor group or nobody had come forward and put something in to actually show that, regardless of what the state is saying, there are serious shortcomings and still, as far as we're concerned, breaches of the UN Convention to a certain extent. And so basically we decided what we would do is we'd strip it back to the very first three major questions that were asked, and we formulated a report on that.
What were the three questions, Anne-Marie?
They were around the prosecutions providing proper rehabilitation and redress. So basically we broke the report up into three sections, and the first section we looked at the recommendations that were made and how some of the recommendations are still not being implemented.
From the Ryan report.
From the Ryan report, And some children, they're still living in dire needs in this country. The Convention for Human Rights Child had said that they were quite disappointed that some of what they had recommended hadn't still been implemented years later. And I kind of just wanted to give a snapshot of what's going on within care today and children today. The recommendations were supposed to be put in place to protect children. And I just wanted to give a snapshot around the homelessness issue, children coming out of care today, children in care. You know, there is shortcomings regarding these recommendations, that this isn't all hunky-dory and everything has been
sorted
because we've gotten these recommendations. And also, obviously, the memorial was one of the recommendations of Memorial for Survivors. There's been, within the survivor community, a great debate about whether they want a memorial or not. No, that's an issue that I'm not going to go into, because I don't believe that I have the right to discuss that. There was €500,000 put aside for this memorial. It was supposed to go into the Garden of Remembrance, and then it wasn't. And I just had come across that, you know, they're looking at moving the memorial and, or doing something completely different than the memorial. Hadn't engaged with the survivors on the memorial committee. Okay. And to me, that's shocking.
Mm, it's more of it.
It's exactly, literally. And the second part of it, I gave a brief synopsis of, I suppose, the religious order's response, looking at there, for example, prior to the commission, the Taoiseach's apology, obviously in 89, the Commission Act and the Redress Act, religious orders had set up this whole framework document, which was their response to child abuse within the church. And I looked at that, and certain things didn't fall in under the law, so didn't need to be reported. Mm. And so I kind of teased away at that, and I teased away that the Children's First Guidelines had come out in you know, there was a version of them in 1999. Mm. And basically that there was an awareness of child abuse, mm. that there was an awareness that things need to be looked mm. at. However, we go into 1999, the Taoiseach gives his apology, and then we have the redress in the commission, in which there was very few investigations, mm. you know, only one prosecution from the Ryan report. And we're into a situation that how did this happen? Mm. So then I went and I had gotten some statements from individuals who were happy to talk about their experiences of the redress board.
So survivor testimony.
Yeah, and then how they feel about the Ryan report, or those who had engaged in the Ryan report. I also done a section on the deaths within the schools and the death certificates, and considering that Tomb had you know, what's gone on in Tomb and stuff, that I wanted to pose questions to the state. Were they happy with files that they had received? And there has been some where there has been no death certificate, and there has been concerns raised around how certain individuals had died in schools. And, you know, so was the state still happy with the information that it had? Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to pose that to UNCAT. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the last section was the rehabilitation and reparation. And we had, myself, I'd done an independent report and submitted to the Oireachtas, Educational Committee of the Oireachtas. I circulated it to every member of the Oireachtas, actually, around Carinua, the fund that was set up by the state from money provided by religious orders in order to provide for the needs for survivors in relation to health, housing, education, well-being. Mm. When I had been working as a support practitioner, I myself had massive concerns. I'd seen how it had been, was a form of maladministration to certain extents. There was decisions being made that were literally, I couldn't understand them. Mm. It was very frustrating. It was impacting people on an emotional, psychological and health level.
Yeah. You mentioned that it was actually a re-traumatising process for people.
Yeah, I speaking to a survivor there the other day, and I'd asked him about his Carinua and whatever, and he had told me that he had just completely disengaged them. He was having such a difficult time that it was affecting his mental health, mm. and he just had to step away. I mean, this is shocking, mm. absolutely shocking. So I'd done a report, and Fiona, who since UNCAT has joined the board,
Fiona Fox,
and she had done a report, and then we'd kind of, Fiona combined them she wrote the section on Carinua, and combined the reports. And we had gotten, you know, letters from psychologists and psychosocial supports regarding their underground
professional experiences.
Yeah, absolutely, of Carinua, and how they feel that this is a system that is exceptionally flawed and it's not providing many survivors with what it should be. So we brought that to UNCAT, and also we made a point that survivors' children, under the UN Convention, victims also include family members. And so survivors' children, many of them are in need of some form of support, whether it's educationally or not. But when the Education Finance Board, which was a fund that was set up by the department, over $12 million, for survivors, their family members, to engage in some form of education, it was set up in a sort of a free-for-all, so you were able to come in, your family were able to come in and get some funding. And it could be something as simple as driving lessons, mm-hmm. basic stuff, and it could be to go to third-level education. There was a range of what you could apply for. But the money was kind of gobbled up a bit, and then they brought in I suppose, limitations to what you could apply for financially and stuff, and that had to be done. But unfortunately, that money ran out, and many survivors' children who were younger didn't actually get to access that.
Sure, right.
And so there's been this whole deficit then of survivor children who haven't been able to access that kind of, you know,
support.
Yeah. And we wanted to kind of show that survivors children need to be, there needs to be something provided for them outside of the Cara Nua, outside of anything, because there needs to be something set
trying
up
to bear witness to their own,
for their own road to go down, you know, and provide some form of support.
And was the UNCAT experience worthwhile?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't going to go. I had done the report and I wasn't going to go. Fiona was going to go on her own. And I decided kind of, no, I'm going to go last minute.
I've invested a lot in this.
Literally, I'd written the first number of sections on the report and I'd done the bulk of the research and I kind of felt, no, I shouldn't really go. Fiona, I suppose, begging me to go. So I went and I really was unsure. It's really daunting to think that you're going and you're going to could be asked
UN,
questions.
Yeah.
And it's UN. And you really are kind of, oh my God. You know, I was hoping that nobody'd ask me anything. But luckily beforehand, IREC had put a group, everybody together.
Yeah.
We were grouped into the historical abuse issues and ourselves, Survivors and Physiotomy, Justice for Magdalens, Adoption Rights Alliance. And we had realised that because there were so many groups gone over this time, everybody was only given a period of time to talk, quite a short period of time. And also the information from the informal to the formal NGO session had to be different. It had to be informative.
Yeah.
So myself and Fiona had given a wish list at the end of our report, the very, very last page of our report. And we wanted to extend that. We called for a consultation with survivors so that, you know, experience of supports that had been put in place and the state's response, but including what's needed now, needs to be consulted, it needs to be looked at, it needs to be mediated by outside individuals, and it needs to be really, really
properly inclusive.
We also called for, you know, and within that we were hoping that survivors, we didn't believe that we had the right to tell what should be included in that consultation, but we felt that, you know, like survivors would bring forward what they had been talking to us about and what they've been saying themselves for years, which is pensions, education funds, you know, redress for those who didn't get it. These kind of things, access to files was another one. And we called for that a specialist inquiry team should be able to go in and access the files and do some form of investigation on the alleged abuses to find out, you know, are the people still working with children and...
Which is terrifying.
Yeah, and has there been other allegations and stuff like that? We called for that. We also had asked that the suicide rates within the survivor community to be fully looked at and properly researched. I know the NSRF had done a great report in 2007, and I think that needs to be extended more. And the premature deaths, even the high mortality rates within survivors at a younger age, needs to be looked at. So we called for a lot of things. We joined forces, us and the other groups that were there for historic institution like child abuse. Mary O'Connor, the chairperson from Survivors and Physiotomy, had done a joint statement.
A powerful one too.
An absolutely brilliant one. Yeah. And I remember she was saying, "Who wants to read it?" And I was like, "Nobody else should be allowed to read it, only you." It was so powerful. It was so powerful that Felice Kerr, the vice chairperson of the UNCAT committee, referred to it and quoted directly from it.
Yeah, the Nigel Riley
And
she stuck it to the stage.
And so, I mean, we kind of had developed this, and then we had the joint statement that we'd done at the informal NGO, and I felt Felice had been really receptive to myself and Fiona. We got an awful lot of time from her before the NGO sessions, afterwards, when the state were there, you know, when the state were up. And to be quite frank, I feel that as an individual, but as a member of UNCAT, she has so much interest in ensuring that survivors of historic institute child abuse get their just deserved, you know, dues, basically. She's very concerned about the lack of investigations. It's something that she kept bringing up, survivors' needs, children's needs, and we talked about the educational needs and stuff. But she had talked about a transitional justice mechanism in Ireland, and she had called for Pablo de Grief, a special rapporteur on transitional justice, you know, would the state invite him over? Of course, the state had said there was an open invitation to all rapporteurs. And we were really happy, really excited by what had been discussed at the UNCAT regarding the recommendations when they came out, concluding observations, should I say. We looked at them and we had thought that there would have been other things in there. But when we took a step back from it and I reread the whole historical abuse section, I actually believe the police had broken the work up between us as organisations.
Right, okay.
And I feel that she had called us and to work together as organisations, which is something that we have discussed at length between us.
Well, it makes sense because they're shared issues.
Yeah, the issues are you know, very similar. Records, investigations, prosecutions. I think she, the work was broken up in between us. And when I kind of sat back and I looked at that, I was quite happy, very happy actually, with how the report was received and the information that was taken out of it to follow up with the state.
Final question, Anne-Marie. Where to from here for Reclaiming Self?
Quite a lot. Our remit is bigger than just the industrial schools. Now, we've done a couple of letters to the Department of Justice and to Dublin City Council that I've spoken to Maeve O'Rourke, Justice Magdalene's research that I was going to submit. And so we've been kind of working closely side by side in relation to some forms, in relation to some issues. We don't want to obviously cross into other people's remits when they're doing such a great job and they've said the same about us. We just want to be able to support each other and
I guess promote shared goals.
Absolutely, because they are shared goals. We are most certainly in the process of following up with the recommendations and stuff that we put in our report for the UN. Obviously, the state have to have their answers to the recommendations, I think, some point this year. So we'll be
in the follow-up procedure.
Yeah, the follow-up procedure. So we will be definitely putting in stuff there. We've had a couple of meetings with other, with other organisations, and we've talked about how we are, looking at these shared goals and how we can work collectively on them as well as independently on the specific ones that are remit specific to individual organisations. We have some reports coming out. We've been dealing with Karanua. Fiona was again in the Times again at the weekend regarding the appeals debacle that we had come across. We've been at meetings and we're finally, hopefully, going live on our website next weekend.
Okay.
Or the weekend coming, one or the other.
ReclaimingSelf.ie?
ReclaimingSelf.ie. We have taken on interns who've been at UNCAT themselves, who are working with us to do reports from human rights. We've psychology masters, people after coming in, and you know, we're really looking to, if anybody wants to, is interested in kind of joining ranks or interested in touching base with us, then
check out the website.
No, which shouldn't be done next week. But yeah, we want to try and put our public face there and try and be more informative and more reachable, basically. Mm-hmm. We're not providing services. We're trying to provide advocacy as a result of the state's response and look at the state's response. And I think at the moment, some people are finding that difficult to understand why I'm gone from support work and why I've done this, but I think that ultimately in order to provide proper support work we need proper structures.
Sure.
And there's a massive systematic flaw that needs to be addressed before we can really look at anything else. So that's the main goal, one of many.
was Jane Mulcahy speaking with Anne-Marie Crean, co-founder of Reclaiming Self. Up next, we have Dr. Conor O'Mahony, who addressed the Citizens Assembly speaking on the legal regulation of referendum campaigns. Dr. O'Mahony spoke on the legal regulation of referendum campaigns, including the use of public funds, the rules governing campaign donations, the regulation of media coverage, and the role of the Referendum Commission. The Assembly made a range of recommendations on ways in which the referendum process could be improved, and these will be considered by the Houses of the Oireachtas. Dr. O'Mahony's address was kindly made available to us by the Referendum Commission.
Nice to be here to speak to you this morning. My paper follows on quite neatly from Niamh's paper earlier on. So Niamh was concerned with the legal rules governing what it takes to pass a referendum and to get it across the line and for a constitutional amendment to become law. The focus of my paper is a little different, obviously connected to that, but what I'm really looking at are the rules governing the campaign period. So from the time that a referendum is called, namely when the referendum bill is passed by the Oireachtas, up to the polling day when the votes are actually taken, there are a set of legal principles which govern what is to happen, things that can happen or must happen, and other things that may not happen during that period. So I'm going to run through these and to flag the key principles and then to flag some of the discussion points which have arisen over the years around how well those principles work. So I'm not here to advocate a particular outcome, but just to flag some things which you might like to discuss during your deliberations to set up the possible recommendations you might make. Like Niamh, I don't have PowerPoint slides, but my paper is in your packs, and I'll be following that fairly closely, so you might find it useful to have that in front of you. The first thing that I want to look at is the whole issue of funding, and I want to look at that from two different angles. First of all, the question of the role of public funds in referendum campaigns, and then secondly, private funds. So to begin with public funds, this is an issue which is regulated by the Constitution. Now, interestingly, if you picked up the Constitution and read it trying to find the rules on public funding, you won't find them very easily because they're not really stated explicitly in the Constitution. But as Niamh mentioned earlier on, the Constitution states a number of very broad principles, and then those principles are expanded upon in the courts. And two of those principles, one of them being the general principle around democracy and the role that the people have in the referendum process, and then secondly, the broad principle of equality, have been read together by the courts in two decisions which were mentioned briefly earlier, the McKenna decision and the McChrystal decision, as imposing very particular rules around the use of public funds during referendum campaigns. And to put it at its most simple, the government is precluded from directly using public money to advocate for a particular result in a referendum campaign. That originally stems from the McKenna judgment, which concerned the second divorce referendum in 1995. On that occasion, the government had used £500,000 Irish pounds, as it then was, in an overt campaign in which they were advocating a yes vote. And that was found to take essentially the democratic rights of those who were in favour of the vote and to place those on a higher pedestal than those who were opposed to it, and thus to be an unconstitutional interference with the democratic process. So the McKenna judgment established pretty clearly that the use of public funds to advocate on one side is off limits. Now, there was some discussion after McKenna as to whether that is too restrictive a rule, given that a government will be elected quite often with a particular constitutional reform agenda, and that if they have that democratic mandate to carry out that agenda, there was some discussion around whether it is too restrictive to say that they can't use public funds in pushing an agenda which has already been approved to one level during a general election. But those recommendations ultimately, or that discussion didn't ultimately go anywhere. And instead, what we see on the other hand was the McKenna principles being strongly reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in a later case called McChrystal, which concerned the children referendum. So McChrystal did two things. One was it reaffirmed that public money cannot be used on either side of the argument, or at least on one side only. And secondly, McChrystal went a little further than McKenna in that McKenna concerned overt campaigning. So while in McKenna the government was very clearly saying we're pushing for a yes vote and we're using this money for that purpose, McChrystal was concerned with an information campaign which was supposed to be neutral. So the government was, in one sense, trying to comply with the McKenna rules by saying this is just information, it's not advocacy for a yes vote. But when the materials were examined, it was found that the general tone of the materials, and the paper gives some examples of what I mean by that, was biased on the yes side of the argument. And the court accepted that this was unintentional, that there was no question of bad faith on the part of the government. But nonetheless, what McChrystal establishes is that the government can even unintentionally breach the McKenna principles if the information which is provided using public funds isn't neutral and impartial information. So that's the basic rule. The discussion points, which I'm just going to briefly flag on that, surround really the scope of that rule. How far does it extend? So we know it covers direct expenditure. What is a little less clear is the extent to which indirect expenditure is covered. So in both cases, the court would have said, for example, that ministers can use state transport while on the campaign trail. So that would be an example of indirect expenditure, which is still favouring one side of the campaign over the other. And there are all sorts of other ways in which money might indirectly find its way into assisting one side of a campaign more than another, be that in the form of public funds provided to political parties or to civil society groups, for example. The other question which is interesting to consider is the difference between the rules which apply once the referendum campaign has been called, when clearly direct expenditure is prohibited, versus the question of what the rules are before the referendum is called. So some referendums, as we know, involve lengthy periods of public discussion before the formal referendum campaign. As currently read, if you were to look at McKenna and McChrystal, it would seem the rules only kick in once the referendum has been called. And so there's a discussion to be had around whether it's appropriate for any rules to apply prior to that point. Is it acceptable for public funds to be used in a way that might advocate a constitutional amendment before the actual formal campaign period? So that's the McKenna and McChrystal rules. And they govern the use of public funds. And obviously, because of those rules, one implication of that is that the vast majority of funding for referendum campaigns has to come from private sources. So we also then have separate rules which govern the use of private funds. And these take a number of different forms. So there's three main ways you can regulate private funding of referendum campaigns. One would be placing limits or rules around donations to campaigns. A second would be to place limits on spending by campaign groups. And then the third is around disclosure requirements so that there is transparency in where the money is coming from and what it's being spent on. So what we have in Ireland is we have two of those three. So we have limits which are in place around donations that can be made to campaign groups. Those are set out in the paper and they vary depending on the nature of the donation. €100 for an anonymous donation, €200 for individual donations, €200 for unregistered corporate donors, or €2,500 for registered corporate donors. Foreign donations are prohibited unless they're from an Irish citizen. So that, broadly speaking, is the set of rules around limits on donations that may be made to campaigns. What we don't have in Ireland are any rules on what can be spent. So you are limited in the size of the donations you can accept from a single donor in a single year, but you can spend every penny that you can raise. Now, the two sort of balance each other out in some ways because the limits on donations are such that in a small country like Ireland, there is something of a natural limit to how much money a campaign will realistically be able to raise. What is, I suppose, somewhat outside of the scope of the regulation would be private individuals. So campaign groups, you know, political parties and campaign groups such as civil society groups are covered by these rules, but private individuals are not. So in essence, private individuals can, you know, if you had a very wealthy individual, they could spend pretty much whatever they wanted in advocating for a particular outcome in a referendum campaign. So that's one thing which falls outside the scope of our current rules. We have disclosure requirements, which again are set out in the paper. So where you have a political party or a civil society group which accept donations above these thresholds, then there are requirements in place around accounts which must be opened to handle those donations, around reports which must be made to the Standards and Public Office Commission every year, and the information which must be disclosed. And so there is a fair degree of architecture around that. So looking at Ireland then, and looking at those rules in a sort of international context to see how we compare to other countries on that. On the question of donations, our rules are reasonably strict. The limits which we impose here are relatively low limits. The disclosure requirements are reasonably onerous. And we're also somewhat unusual in the fact that we apply these rules to both political parties and civil society groups. So if you look at comparable countries in the OECD, for example, the majority of countries wouldn't apply those rules across both political parties and civil society groups in the same way as we do. On the other hand, a lot of countries do have limits on expenditure, which we don't have at all. So that is another way in which we differ from a lot of trends. So if you take one practical example I've given, just to see how we look a little bit different to one of our near neighbours, if you look at, for example, the Scottish independence referendum and the way that would have been managed. In the Scottish referendum campaign on independence, there was no limit on donations, so parties could take, groups on either side could take donations as large as they wanted, which would certainly differ from our rules, but then they were limited in what they could spend. There was the lead campaign groups had a total spending limit of 1.5 million, and then there were other smaller separate limits for political parties. And that looks quite different to what we do in that while they could take donations as big as they want but could only spend so much, we do it the other way around. We say you can spend as much as you want, but we limit what you can actually accept from individual people. So it's different. And there's, a discussion to be had around which is the more effective way of trying to ensure that each side of the campaign gets an equal crack of the whip. Another thing which is done in other countries which we don't do is channeling public funds directly to campaign groups. So setting aside a sum of money and saying that each side of the campaign is going to receive a certain sum of money from public funds in order to run their campaign. And that would be a relatively commonplace arrangement in a number of different countries. It's not something we do here. There is the question how that would comply with the McKenna principle. And I think views may differ on this. My view would be that as long as an equal amount of funding was provided on each side, that would be compatible with McKenna, but it would have to be an equal sum of money given to both sides. There are questions then as to exactly how you would make that work, how you could regulate that and police it, which is a separate discussion. But that is something which is done in a number of comparable countries, but which, as I say, we don't currently do. The onus is on the campaign groups to raise their own funds. So that's the architecture around public and private funding. Moving on then to the third point, which is the rules concerning media coverage, and in particular broadcast coverage. And this is something which many of you will have encountered. If you pay attention to referendum campaigns, you will come across this whole notion of balance in the coverage, the style of debates we have where you have two people from either sides of the argument and where broadcasters are going to great lengths to ensure that they receive equal time. Now, the rules governing this, interestingly, are not specific to referendums. So the relevant rule comes from the Broadcast Act, and the Broadcast Act is not something which is referendum specific. It's something which applies to broadcasters at all times. And the Broadcast Act requires, and the section is in full in the paper, but it requires that the treatment of current affairs must be fair to all interests concerned. The broadcast matter must be prevented in an objective and impartial manner and without any expression of the broadcaster's own views. So those are the general principles, and those apply at all times, whether there's a referendum being held or not. Now, they tend to become a particular focus during referendum campaigns because of a judgment which again goes back to the divorce referendum of 1995, which is the Colin judgment. And that concerned an issue which arose during the divorce referendum where essentially you'd all be familiar with the idea of a party political broadcast. And during the referendum campaign, RTE afforded each side the sort of referendum equivalent of a party political broadcast, which were 10-minute slots to set out their case for either voting yes or voting no. And what they did was they offered a slot each to the main political parties, and then one slot each to the main campaign groups. But because all of the political parties were all advocating a yes vote, the net effect was that the yes side received 40 minutes of uncontested broadcast time to advocate for a yes vote, whereas the no side received only 10 minutes to do the same on the no side. So that ultimately was found by the Supreme Court to be a breach of the Broadcast Act. Now, I think if you look at the requirement in the Broadcast Act that you must be fair to all interests concerned, then the idea of 40 minutes of uncontested airtime on one side versus only 10 minutes on the other, it's not a big stretch to say that that falls short of adhering to that principle. The question then is, how do you implement that in other circumstances? And what we've seen over the years is that the implementation of this principle has really focused very much on that idea of equal time. That because the problem in Colin was unequal time, there's a sense that you must give equal time in all circumstances. And they were uncontested broadcasts, remember. But what we see very often is that that has now translated into a requirement of equal time, even in the cut and thrust of a contested debate. And of course, that's much more difficult to make it work. It's quite easy to say if you have your 10-minute broadcast, we equalise those. But in a back and forth, in a robust debate, it's very, very difficult to ensure that each side has equal time, perhaps unrealistic. But what we see very often is broadcasters using stopwatches during contested debates to try and adhere to that idea of equal time. And there is a question to be discussed around whether or not that broad principle of being fair to all interests and concerned in the Broadcast Act really is a more flexible concept than this idea of precise equality of time. And it is questionable whether the call and judgment really requires precise equality of broadcast time in all circumstances. And I think that's something which is worth deliberating on. We've seen it filter beyond equal time into some other areas as well. We have seen it in some instances filtering into unrelated programming. So we have seen circumstances where we've had incidents where people being asked to remove campaign badges from clothing during interviews which had nothing to do with a referendum, or even recent reports about somebody being disinvited from appearing on a TV show for fear that it would be broadcast during a referendum campaign and that there might be some issues arising from that. Many people would view that implementation of the rules as being overly cautious and overly restrictive. Beyond that, there are one or two other points which are worth discussing. One is around the extent to which broadcasters feel free to challenge arguments. So when you have people making claims during referendum campaigns, which may or may not be accurate, broadcasters may feel that it's difficult for them to really challenge those claims robustly, given that the Act says the broadcasters may not express their own view, and there's a fear on the part of broadcasters potentially that they fall into advocating rather than just interrogating. And then finally, the other point which is interesting to consider is the fact that we have this complex body of rules governing the broadcast media, namely radio and television. But when it comes to print media and when it comes to digital media and the increasing prevalence of social media and so on, the rules governing those are far looser, bordering on non-existent. And when you consider the fact that there is now a lot of overlap, I mean, if you look at, for example, the RTE website versus a website run by a major newspaper, each of them will contain print content, video content, audio content. There's very little difference between them. But one of those operators has a very restrictive body of rules governing it. The other can do almost what it likes. So there is a discussion to be had around whether it makes sense to have a very detailed restrictive body of rules governing television and radio while leaving print and digital media comparatively unregulated. Finally then, and I see I only have a couple of minutes left, just to mention the Referendum Commission, and Niamh has already introduced the Referendum Commission to you. The Referendum Commission has the role of distributing information to allow voters to come to an informed view and to make an informed choice at the referendum. It is, of course, bound by the McKenna principles. So, in other words, any information that the Referendum Commission distributes must be impartial and neutral. It cannot provide information which is intentionally or unintentionally biased on either side of the debate. The Referendum Commission used to have the role of setting out the yes and no arguments as well, but that was removed in 2002. And so there's a discussion as to whether or not that was a useful function. Niamh mentioned that earlier on. It was felt that it wasn't working very well. So I suppose something for you to consider is, in your own experience, is that something which you found to be a useful function? There is a question about the difficulty the Referendum Commission has in distributing information which is interesting to voters nowadays, I guess. So follow-up research, for example, after the children referendum is that almost half of voters found the Referendum Commission's ads and media materials to be long and uninteresting. But of course, it's operating in a very restrained environment. Fact-checking is an interesting question around the Referendum Commission. Does it have a role in fact-checking claims made on either side of the campaign? Because, of course, misinformation circulates during referendum campaigns. Is it appropriate or is it useful for the Referendum Commission to fact-check? We've seen different practice on this. In some referendum campaigns, the Commission has addressed campaign arguments, particularly in the marriage referendum. People might remember a lot of claims being made on one side around the connection between that referendum and the issue of surrogacy. The Referendum Commission repeatedly came out and said that, as far as they were concerned, there was no connection between the marriage referendum and the issue of surrogacy. So was that a useful thing for the Commission to do? In other referendum campaigns, we've seen the Commission not do that and staying away from that. The Act is flexible enough. It says the Commission can provide any other information that it considers appropriate. So it essentially gives it a choice to do that or not do it. And so I think it's worth considering, do we think that's useful and do we want the Commission to do that? And finally, then, the last point, which I think Gary mentioned in his discussion, is around the question of whether the Commission should be a permanent body. So the Commission at present is an ad hoc body. It's set up from scratch every time that a referendum is called with a new chairperson, and it has to get up and running in perhaps a very short period of time. And that is a challenging thing for it to do. And so there is a discussion to be had around whether we think it makes sense for a more permanent body to be established, which has more time, more resources, has more of an opportunity to build up expertise in the area. Perhaps not dedicated specifically to referendums because we don't have enough of them maybe to justify that, but it could be combined as part of a broader electoral commission which would regulate not just referendums but general presidential and local elections as well, and so that you wouldn't have that challenge the commission currently faces of having to start from scratch every single time there is a referendum. So that's a suggestion which has been made from various quarters over the years.
Thanks for listening to the first Law and Justice podcast of 2018 on UCC 98.3 FM. We'll be back on Tuesday, January 30th, when Shane will once again be sitting in the hot seat. Thank you very much for listening and enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.